everyone, and welcome to At the Letters for Tuesday, May 20th, 2025. The Blue Jays are about to start a series against the San Diego Padres. And before that gets started, I'm here, Ben Nicholson-Smith, with Arden Zwelling on this episode of At the Letters, produced by Christian Ryan. Arden, how's it going today as you get ready for Jays Padres?
Not bad, man. How are you?
Good, good, good. All good over here after a pretty interesting Jays Tigers series, the inaugural rivalry weekend. And the Jays are 22-24. So we have some sort of version of this conversation on most episodes of At the Letters, but I want to get a big picture sense of where you're at with this team hovering around 500. What do you got with the Jays right now?
They've got to start winning games. Like, it's the exact same thing I would have said last week. And all that's happened since last week is they've dropped two series and started a homestand 2-4. So they're moving in the wrong direction. Like, they're back to two games under 500. Their playoff odds have decreased since we last spoke. It's not like Mayday time yet. Impact is not imminent. But you've basically got like 50 games between now and the All-Star break, and you're going to want to be considerably above 500 by the All-Star break. So they have a lot of work to do. It's a zero-sum game. You win or you lose. There's no room in the standings for close losses or, oh, we were right there with them, or, oh, we battled them tough. Blue Jays just need to start winning games.
Yeah, for sure. Right now, their projected win-loss record of Fangraphs 81-81, which kind of fits with the tone of things so far this season. They've been in the middle. They've stayed in the middle, which, okay, that means they haven't fallen back. They're not completely out of it the way the Orioles are, firing their manager and falling into disarray, it seems. But they have not leaped ahead the way the Yankees have. So that's where the Blue Jays find themselves. And you know, increasingly, as this season wears on and I talk to more people around the game, I'm sure you have these conversations too, Arden, but it really becomes apparent like there aren't a lot of weak teams, especially in the American League. The Jays had a shot against the Angels, kind of blew that one by losing 2 of 3. They'll play the White Sox a bit later. That'll be another chance. But otherwise, there really aren't any easy marks. So at a certain point, to make those gains that we're talking about, they have to make the gains against really good teams. If they want to prove themselves, it has to come against other quality opponents.
Yeah, the Blue Jays are the team that other teams are looking at and saying, oh, hey, we've got a soft spot coming up.
Maybe.
Because we get to play the team that's like two games below 500 and that has had really inconsistent starting pitching and whose offense has looked better lately, but who also is, liable to like get out-dueled by Zach Littell or someone. So the Blue Jays are going to have to beat good teams. It's great that they are competitive with the Tigers. Like, I don't take that away from them, right? The Tigers have been the best team in the AL, and the Blue Jays lost that series 2-1 by a margin of like a run or two.
One run,
right? They were right there in all three of those games, but they didn't win them. And ultimately, the goal is to not only go to the postseason, but to win the World Series. That's been the stated goal of the, like, on the record from the highest highs of management in this organization, is we want to bring a championship back to Canada. And the Blue Jays just aren't positioned to do that right now.
Yeah, it's not where they want to be, that's for sure. At the same time, I have a hard time being too despairing about where things are at this moment, because they're playing in a playoff structure that allows for so many teams to make it. And so if you have six teams from the American League out of the 15 teams making the postseason, they're in it. They still have a chance. Now, again, that's not to say that, great, like, you have a chance in May. Like, of course, that should be the expectation. And you know, that's not anything accomplished on its own. But they are in it still. And if they have a couple of good series, they could find themselves in actually a pretty good position. So this is still early enough in the season where, as much as they've had a lot of stuff kind of go wrong and these past couple series have been pretty rough, I still think that they have a chance to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish. And it's almost like if the Blue Jays are going to have a season where they hover around 500 and then they make a move and then they're finally in the playoff race and they make the playoffs and everything is really going well for them, it could very well look like this. And at the same time, if they were going to have a season where they hover around 500, then it kind of falls apart. They don't have enough depth. They end up being sellers. it could also look like this. So I guess we're just in that period of time where they need to create that separation one way or the other.
Sure. And if we were talking about the Tigers team that we just saw at this time last year, we would have been like, wow, who are they going to trade at the trade deadline? And then they did trade those players at the trade deadline. And we all know what happened after that. They've been the best team in the American League since basically the beginning of August last year. So it's still baseball. There's still room for baseball things to happen, but it's hard to come here and say, you know, the Blue Jays are really surging. They're really making a push. Yeah. Look out for this team. They're a sleeping giant. You know, I think that over the last couple of weeks, like, the offense has undeniably been better. You know, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette are both hitting incredibly well. Would you like to have more power from Vlad? Sure. But, like, it's hard to argue with a guy who's getting on base at, like, a 50% clip over the last 2 weeks.
And there's some of that Vladdy power. Did he get enough of it? He sure did.
Good timing there.
He went after that high fastball and hit it into the bullpen. Number
491 OBP over the last 14 days for Vlad. So that means that, like, that half the time he isn't making an out. It's incredible. Bo Bichette's been hitting incredibly well. Very, very interesting free agency case coming up for him. I mean, Addison Barger obviously has been a revelation. Early commence, turn it around. Alejandro Kirk's having great plate appearances. Dalton Varsho leads the team in home runs. Like, the offense is starting to show up. The problem is right now, like, the pitching just hasn't been there over the last couple of weeks. Like, this, the classic, we can't get it all synced up at the same time. When we pinch, we can't hit. And when we hit, we can't pitch. And when we pitch and we hit, we make outs on the base paths or we commit errors in the field. Like, it's that classic Blue Jays problem of the last several years where things aren't summed up. The whole is less than the sum of its parts, however you want to put it. That seems to be what's happening again.
And I think when that sort of thing happens, basically, that's just a sign that you're more of an average team than a great team, right? Because the great teams put it together in all those different phases of the game simultaneously, and they do it for extended stretches, not for 162 games, but they might do it for a month at a time or 2 weeks at a time. And most teams can't do that. The ordinary teams can't do that. And so the Blue Jays look like an ordinary team at this point. Can they be on the good side of ordinary? Maybe. Can they go way above ordinary? I mean, I'm not ruling it out. But at this point, they're looking pretty ordinary. And to your point, when you have the starting pitching just not producing the way that they have in the past, the way that you might hope that they would, this is a group that by Fangraphs WAR, it's an imperfect stat, but it gives you an idea of where things are going here. By Fangraphs WAR, this starting rotation is 29th in baseball among the 30 teams. And the only team with less Fangraphs WAR is the Baltimore Orioles, who, you know, as we mentioned, are just off to an abysmal start. So there's room for improvement here, whether we're talking about Bowden Francis, whether we're talking about even Gausman and Berríos, and of course the fifth spot, which has been wide open. So if you have that kind of struggles at the back of your rotation, particularly the 4 and 5 spots, then you're going to have strain on the bullpen. Then you're going to have this trickle-down effect where some of the guys don't perform to their expectations coming in relief. And you end up, like I said, looking more ordinary than special.
Yeah, the Blue Jays have real issues at 4 and 5 in their rotation right now. And the top three are going to be the top three as long as they're healthy. They've been inconsistent. I think the Blue Jays could just use some more reliability out of those top three, but it's not like you're making any changes there. You know, at 4 with Bowden Francis, you're getting to a point where I think soon the Blue Jays are going to have to consider his viability in the rotation going forward, because he's given up too many home runs, he's given up too much hard contact. He's not getting deep enough into his outings. I mean, he has a 5.63 ERA at this point, and over his last 4 starts, it's an 8.68 ERA. He's allowed 18 earned runs over his last 18 and two-thirds innings, 28 hits over the last 18 and two-thirds. I have 8 home runs over those 18 and two-thirds. And obviously that includes, like, the blow-up outing against the Red Sox, which was no good, very bad, not great at all. But that also includes, like, 4 earned over 4 1/3 against Cleveland and 4 earned over 4 2/3 against Detroit when he gave up 2 homers. So he needs to turn things around quickly, probably prior to Spencer Turnbull getting here, because when Spencer Turnbull does get here, I think the Blue Jays will have a decision to make there. There's also the number five spot in this rotation where Max Scherzer threw three innings to begin the year, and then it's just been like try to figure it out since. And Easton Lucas was the answer there until he wasn't. And Eric Lauer has shown some flashes, but the Blue Jays have kind of told you how much they trust him in the way that they have used him. And, you know, the one game that the Blue Jays won in that Tigers series was that fifth spot in the rotation, incredibly, because, like, John Schneider managed his ass off in that game. I mean, six pitchers over nine innings, like, each one of them targeting, like, just the perfect pocket for them, like, really reaching into the depths of his bullpen, getting the two innings out of Yariel was huge. And then Brandon Little, Chad Green, Jimmy Garcia, I mean, Jeff Hoffman, like just really squeezing everything out of the sponge of that bullpen. It was a great job by John Schneider and Pete Walker, DeMarlo Hale, Don Mattingly, everybody who contributes to that. But like, that's not sustainable. Asking your bullpen to do that every fifth day is not sustainable. So the Blue Jays need a solution there. So as far as getting more stability from the starting rotation, you need answers at four and five, and you need more consistency from one through three.
So you hinted that, you know, Bowden Francis, his spot in the rotation might have to be sort of evaluated there. And I guess to an extent, you know, of course, everyone's always being evaluated in the major leagues. I think he's safe for a while. I think even if Turnbull is healthy, producing, stretched out, ready to go, I think he would take that five spot more so than threatening the Francis spot. But I actually see those spots as being kind of connected. And I think that the struggles of Francis in a weird way are actually connected to them not having a fifth starter. And I'll kind of explain that here. So you can tell me what you think. But I think the Jays have pushed Francis deeper into games at times than what the analytics might say that you quote unquote should do. They've asked him to take on maybe a third time through the order. Maybe it's a close game. And, you know, Bowden Francis is at 70 pitches, so he's fine to keep going physically. And your bullpen's already been used pretty heavily, probably going to have to be used again heavily the following day because Bowden Francis' spot is right before that number five spot. So you know you're going to need a lot of relief help that next day. Don't want to tax the bullpen too much. And so they push him a little further into games. But if you look at the results for Bowden Francis, we're talking about someone who has been hit very hard third time through the order. And, you know, obviously you have to watch the game. I'm not saying you want to be a slave to analytics or anything like that, but I'll give you the numbers here for Francis. When he faces an opponent third time through in a game, they're hitting 371 against him. The OPS against is 1,136. So opponents are absolutely destroying Bowden Francis third time through. And that's generally the case across the league. When hitters see pitchers the third time through, they do better. And I think that Francis's numbers would look better and the Blue Jays pitching staff as a whole would look better if they had a little bit more depth to tap into on those days that Francis is starting. But because they're essentially doing bullpen games in the number five spot, they have to push him further and get worse results.
Yeah, this comes up a lot throughout the season where it's, oh man, why didn't they go to that reliever in that spot? It's so obvious. Why didn't they see that? And so much more often it's about what's happening tomorrow versus what's happening today and just understanding like how many innings have to be covered over the rest of the week. Or it might even be like the last game of a series and you know that the team that's coming to town tomorrow for the next 3 days has like this pocket of lefties that you're really going to want Brandon Little, fresh to face. So you don't use him today to target that lefty with a couple of runners on and you leave Bowden Francis in against him because you're thinking, well, I really need him to be available for that upcoming series. And if I use him here, I don't have him in game one of that series. I might not even have him in game two, depending on how things go. So like you make a great point. But I think also Bowden Francis is just getting hammered regardless of which trip through the order it is.
Right.
The hard hit rate against him this year, 51%. Over half the contact he's allowed has been hard hit. That's led to like an expected ERA that's even higher than his actual ERA, which is over 5.5. The Savant page is going to be deep, deep, deep blue for him. You know, when he has mislocation, when he has mis-executed, he has done so over the heart of the plate. It hasn't been like, oh, Bowden Francis hit four guys in this outing. You know, he just wasn't able to get in the zone. His problem has been being too much in the zone, too far over the heart of the plate, not enough towards the edges. As we've seen, when his fastball's over the heart of the plate, when his splitter's over the heart of the plate, big league hitters have a pretty easy time seeing it and turning it around at a high rate of speed.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a strength of his, right? It's definitely a strength of his that he has so much conviction and he will challenge hitters. And we said this from the moment that Bowden Francis debuted in the major leagues and started having a little success out of the bullpen. You can go back and listen to those ATL episodes where we're saying like, man, this guy, like, he actually pitches with a lot of conviction and you got to give him credit. He's going out there with like 92 to 93 miles an hour. He's just going after hitters. And for a long time it worked. And now it's not working as well. And to your point, yeah, they're hitting him first time through the order. They're hitting him second time through the order. It's worse third time through, but they're hitting him pretty consistently. You know, it's not that dissimilar from Berríos at times, where when Berríos is, for the most part, when he has his days where it's not as good, he's missing middle-middle. He's not missing and walking six hitters. That's going to happen when you have strike throwers who don't have, like, dominant stuff. But I don't necessarily see a way through it other than just continuing to hand Bowden Francis the ball. And I think that's where things are going to land for the Jays.
Yeah, no, that's my point, is like until Spencer Turnbull gets here or until Eric Lauer earns some more trust, yeah, I think Bowden Francis keeps making his starts. And it's like, it's not just a pick on him, because it's been the Blue Jays staff as a whole. Like, just outside of Chris Bassett, nobody on the Blue Jays starting staff has done a particularly good job of managing hard contact. You know, like Bowden Francis has a 12% barrel rate. That's lower than Kevin Gausman's. You know, the guy who is giving up a 51% hard hit rate this year has a lower barrel rate than Kevin Gausman. Like, Kevin Gausman's getting barreled when he misses,
yeah,
when his splitter is not moving vertically, when it's moving horizontally and it's staying up over the plate, it's getting hit really hard. Eric Lauer, for as good as he's looked and for the strikeouts that he's gotten, when he's missed on the plate, like, he's gone barreled. Think about the ball to the left in that Detroit series, in that Detroit outing. It was a changeup, and a really bad changeup that he left up over the heart of the plate. Yarel Rodriguez, same thing. Like, when he's been mislocating sliders up in the zone, or he's been leaving fastballs in bad areas of the zone, they've gotten hit very hard. And Jose Berríos's like whole thing over the last few years has been allowing really hard contact and just like having base runners essentially all the time and finding ways to navigate out of that. That's why he has like consistently run an expected ERA well above his actual ERA, which is the case again this year. But, you know, we're still, again, talking about a guy who has a nearly 12% barrel rate against, and like, that is not a stat that you want to be in the double digits. It's not a stat that you want to be in the high single digits.
No.
And you know, when you're talking about Francis, Berríos, Gausman, you've got three starters right there who are running barrel rates in the 11 to 12 to 13% range, and that is not great.
Yeah, I do think it can change quickly, because a lot of that comes down to pitch location. There's some randomness in there too, because it has to do with what the hitters are looking for, what specific hitters you're facing in a given moment. I think the pitchers can control pitch location, even if there's stuff, because no one's expecting a dramatic stuff improvement from these guys mid-season. It kind of, you got what you got at this point. But I do think pitch location can improve, and that can help a pitching staff that to this point in the season has allowed more home runs than anyone but the Orioles. So that's 68 home runs allowed by the Blue Jays, Baltimore at 72, the other 28 teams below 68. So the home runs definitely a problem for the Jays. For me, just to be clear on Francis, like, I'm rolling with him. I don't see that as a question right now, but Turnbull, yeah, he can definitely take over that number five spot if he's ready, because Scherzer, you know, he hasn't been able to continue the progression of throwing to hitters, so he's not close to coming back. Turnbull might be closer to coming back than Scherzer probably is at this point.
Yeah, and Turnbull's coming here to start. Like, he's being stretched out to 85 to 100 pitches. They're treating him as a starter. They got him on that five-day routine. So I think one way or another, likely as the number five, Spencer Turnbull's coming here to start games initially, and then we'll kind of see how things go from there. You're right. It's the stuff is the stuff on the rotation, and even, like, coming into the season, it's not like any of us looked at this Blue Jays rotation as like a bunch of strikeout artists. It's not like we kind of sat there and said, this is a bunch of guys who are going to all strike out like 30% of the hitters that they face. You know, Kevin Gausman is the one guy who you can kind of bet on to run a really high strikeout rate. But we also haven't seen him have that kind of strikeout stuff consistently for what, a year and a half now? I mean, we've seen flashes of it. We've seen those times that he goes out there with 98. We've seen those times when the splitter is getting 9, 10, 11 whiffs in an outing. But we haven't seen it as consistently as we did a couple of years ago.
He got a 98 at the knees. What a pitch there from Gausman. But Josh Lowe has homered, and it is 5.
And so you even look at, like, the strikeout rates this year. The Blue Jays starter who has the highest strikeout rate is Chris Bassitt.
Yeah.
And that's the guy who's like throwing 92 with a sinker and using six different pitches and trying to kitchen sink you and think ahead of hitters and turn left when they think that he's going right. So none of these pitchers, and that just kind of that assumes Kevin Gausman in current form, are going to be high strikeout pitchers, which makes it even more important that their command, their execution, their location is as pinpoint as possible. Like, they need to be having high edge rates, and that's the percentage of pitches that you locate around the edges of the strike zone. And that just hasn't been there for these guys. I just think that they have missed location and they have mis-executed too often, and they've paid the price for it. And like, they've all been accountable to that, by the way. Like, yeah, we're in these scrums after every game, right? After every game, we talk to the starter, and I've heard it from Kevin Gausman, from Jose Berríos, from Bowden Francis, from Chris Bassitt. Like, I've heard it from every single one of them. I need to be better. I need to execute better. I need to command better. Like, they've all been highly accountable because they hold themselves to a really high standard. And they've been really, really good for a really long time. Like, they were the bedrock of this team for the last 2 to 3 years. They logged a ton of innings, and they were all quality innings, and they saved this team on a lot of days, and they saved the bullpen on a lot of days. But the rotation just hasn't been up to that standard to this point, and they're going to have to be better, as they say, going forward if this team's going to go where it's trying to go.
Yeah, I think that's worth noting for sure, just that these guys have been so accountable, and they're saying really similar stuff to what we're saying, if not even more, you know, harsh and more self-critical. There's no question that they expect a ton of themselves, and there's some frustration, but I think at the same time they're keeping an even keel here, and a lot of the leadership of this team, I think, comes from Berríos and Chris Bassitt and Kevin Gausman. I think that, you know, on the pitching side especially, those three do a really good job. And, you know, like we said, the stuff is the stuff. But as far as the behind the scenes, how these guys show up, how these guys prepare, Berríos, Bassitt, Gausman, that's a really, really good trio of pitchers to have leading the way as far as setting a tone and trying to get the most out of what you actually have.
And if you want to talk about the part of this team that hasn't necessarily carried its weight over the last couple of years, it hasn't been the starting pitching, you know?
Right.
And at no point did any of those guys come out and say, well, yeah, geez, maybe if I had like four runs, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe if I wasn't throwing every pitch like it had to be perfect because I only ever get a run or two to work with. Like, geez, maybe if I wasn't in leverage every time out, wow, maybe if I could pitch to the score a little bit just once. None of them ever said that. They all came out and they talked about pitching and they talked about themselves, and they said for year after year, the offense is going to come around. These guys are going to be better. Don't worry. Look at the names on these lockers. Of course, these guys are going to be better. Of course, this is going to work. So at no point have they pointed fingers anywhere but themselves. So it even like feels a little unfair just to be criticizing or just acknowledging that the starting pitching hasn't been good enough this year. But it's also a fact, it's a reality, and we have to say it. We just also have to acknowledge just how good and how consistent these guys have been over a very long period of time for this team when its offense was still sorting itself out.
Yep. As people, as teammates, they're showing up. They are doing exactly what you would want as performers on the field it hasn't gone exactly the way the Blue Jays would have hoped. So we'll leave it there for now on the pitching side. When we come back on At the Letters, we will continue by looking at the Blue Jays offense. We are back on At the Letters, and we are going to discuss Anthony Santander. Look, Arden, there's no point in trying to pretend otherwise. It's just not going well right now. Not to say it can't turn around and won't turn around. Let's acknowledge that. But, man, the at-bats right now are not looking good. His timing is just so clearly off. And, you know, I am far from some sort of hitting savant. I'll acknowledge that from the start. But it's pretty obvious. You see him at the plate on the weekend. He's calling time and the pitch is delivered. He has a half-hearted swing at it. He's getting caught in between. This is pretty obvious. I'm sitting in the left field press box and I can see how far off he is from being where he needs to be at the plate. And these things can shift quickly. It is not to say that this is where he's going to stay offensively this season, but right now his timing doesn't look good.
Yeah, I don't think that you can say otherwise. And I think it's important to remember that this is a guy who over the months of June and July last year had a 973 OPS and 22 homers in 2 months. 22 homers would be a really good year for a lot of players. And Anthony Santander did that last year in just a third of his. So this is a guy who is capable of turning things around awfully quickly. And you look at his, you know, last May, he hit 207 with a 708 OPS. And then in June, he hit 264. In July, he hit 303. And as I said, his OPS between those 2 months was nearly 1,000 with 22 homers. So you are very much relying on that history repeating itself, because this is pretty similar to what happened to Anthony Santander last year. Now, all that said, the Blue Jays need more, clearly, because as you said, this is not a guy who looks comfortable at the plate. This is not a guy who is hitting the ball hard. This is not a guy who is making the shape of contact that he needs to be successful. But he's still a guy who's getting walked in the ninth, interestingly, to intentionally to bring up Ernie Clement in a real head scratcher based on current form. I think you obviously look at the overall body of work between the two players, and I guess that the Tigers took that information over the more recent information. But I can't push back on what you said about Anthony Santander. I think if you're the Blue Jays, if you're him, if you're a fan, you are just hoping that once June 1 hits, the production turns around in the same way that it did last year.
And clearly, he's not 100% healthy right now, dealing with a little left shoulder soreness after going into the stands in Anaheim, and also a left hip soreness as well. So he is less than 100% physically. Clearly, the Blue Jays believe that that's not going to get worse by playing. Presumably, it will get a little better as he gets some chances to rest, such as the off day Monday, and that he can produce. But it's interesting, like talking to someone with another team about Santander, their impression was like, you know what, we're still scared of this guy. Like we're definitely game planning around him. We're still, you know, not excited to face him, even if he's struggling. So I think that when you look at the big picture and you take yourself a little bit outside of the recency of the last 6 weeks, then this is still a very well-regarded player. He's 30 years old. It's not like he's 35. So I think that on July 20th, you're going to be really happy to have Anthony Santander in the lineup. And on September the 15th, you're going to be really happy about that. Are you that thrilled about it on May 20th? Probably not, the way the ABs are looking, but I do believe that better things are ahead.
Yeah, it's not like there's anything in the plate approach that really sticks out to you. Like the chase rate is, he's actually chasing less this year than he did last year. I mean, the contact rate is similar to where it's been his career. So obviously the same would go for the whiff rate. Like, he's kind of swinging at the same stuff that he's always swung at. It seems like he's just a tick off in something mechanically, which goes like, as you alluded to earlier, well beyond my understanding of the finer details of hitting mechanics. I'll leave that to David Popkins and Lou Iannotti. But I'm not surprised that you're hearing that from other teams, that they're still scared to pitch to him, because he's a guy who's always just one swing away, and he has as much raw power as anybody in this lineup, this side of Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
Just to get out of that inning, as Santander lifts it high and deep down the right field line. and it is gone. A solo home
run. You don't want to make a mistake to him on the time that he gets his foot down on time and takes a big swing and hits a fly ball over a right field fence somewhere. I mean, he's always just that close. But obviously the results at this point have not been good enough. And you're seeing him get dropped in the order for a reason. You're seeing him have mental off days, not just the physical ones, but like one to kind of get his mind right for a reason, because he's going through it right now.
Yeah, he definitely is. And I wonder, too, this is purely a question that I wouldn't expect you or maybe anyone to be able to answer. But, you know, just how much of it is approach, how much of it is essentially the mental prep and you know, readying yourself for that pitch. Not that the effort isn't there, because, you know, we all know he's described as someone who puts in all the work behind the scenes, amazing work ethic. But, you know, mentally, is he caught in between? Is he looking for the wrong pitch? And so, if you're looking for the wrong pitch, if you think a changeup's coming and it's a fastball in on your hands, it doesn't matter what your mechanics are. Like, you're not going to look good on that pitch. So there's got to be an element to here of he's off when it comes to the rhythm, and he's off when it comes to the anticipation that goes with hitting a major league baseball that's traveling somewhere between 80 and 100 miles an hour. So I wonder just how much of it is that plate approach and the mental side.
Yeah, I don't know how much on the mental side, when you hear over and over again that you're a slow starter, does that just become like a self-perpetuating thing? Is it just like, I'm a slow starter, of course I'm starting slow, I'm going to be slow until the weather gets warmer? Like, how much do you just start to believe that? And how much is there a bit of like a nocebo effect, right? Like, where you just like have a negative consequence occur because you mentally are expecting it to occur and you just are perceiving yourself as a slow starter. I don't know. I'm getting well outside my area of expertise by even speculating on such things, but that's kind of what we're left to do when the performance is the way it is, and when he's looked the way he does at the plate, and when we have the understanding of hitting that we do. Like, you know, you'd think like, oh wow, he just needs to get to more fastballs if he's not on time for the breaking stuff and the changeups. Well, he's seeing like more fastballs this year than he has since his rookie season. He's seeing 63.5% fastballs. He's seeing way less breaking stuff than he has before. So like, he's getting the pitches that he needs to do damage on. As you said, he's just been a tick off. He's always been a guy who hits a ton of foul balls. He's always been a guy who hits a ton of pop-ups. I'm not surprised by those results, but you still see sometimes those like crazy swings where like the ball is 2 feet in and he'll somehow chop at it and hit a foul ball directly behind him into the 500 level. And it's like, how do you do that?
Yeah.
Well, that is so bizarre. Like, and sometimes you'll see him like just go through various seasons in the past, you'll see him go down and hit balls off his shoelaces, like well over the wall for home runs. You'll see him go well above the zone for home runs as well. So I think he's just kind of one of those peculiar, weird hitters who is going to be innately streaky. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if there's like a 6-week run in summer where he's like the hottest hitter on the planet.
Yep. I almost expect it, that that's still going to happen, because the through line in all of this, like you said, ton of foul balls, not necessarily a ton of defensive value, and a lot of dingers. And we just haven't seen the dingers yet. The other parts have kind of been there. It might take him a little bit to get fully healthy. I still think that's in there. So let me ask you this and put you on the spot a little bit here. When the Blue Jays signed Anthony Santander, it was 5 years, $92.5 million. Now, the present value of that deal is $68.6 million because of all the deferrals. So 5 years, $68.6 million. If you were, on behalf of the Toronto Blue Jays, making this decision and you could hit Command Z, you could just get out of this deal completely, roster spot is empty, money's off the books, would you walk away or would you keep that deal on the books?
What could I do alternatively, I suppose, would be the question. Because Anthony Santander didn't sign on like the day free agency opened. He signed pretty late into the offseason, and it was after Teoscar Hernandez had signed and after Christian Walker had signed and after Jock Peterson had signed. I'm trying to think of the other guys who were in that kind of category. You know, I think Pete Alonso just wasn't coming to Toronto. He was just always going back to the Mets. So what was your alternative if you don't do Santander at that time, I guess would be my question. Because if you don't have a viable alternative, then you kind of have to do it because it's the best available option.
Right. Okay, that's a good question. It's a little bit tricky to answer in May because clearly there's not much in free agency. I guess if you could have,
you needed power, right? You needed home runs. And where else were you getting that pop from?
And by the way, I think Alonso would have come to Toronto from what I've been told. But, you know, that's a whole other discussion. Let's say you can go back in time and you can re-engage with different free agents and see how things go.
I would probably be more aggressive on Teoscar, I think. Jock Peterson's a guy who I liked a lot, and geez, the results this year tell you why I'm not a GM and never will be.
That's been rough.
I've always liked Tyler O'Neill as a fit with the Blue Jays, but unfortunately, like, the guy just isn't on the field enough. Like, he just, I'd rather have Anthony Santander up there trying to hit than Tyler O'Neill on my IL trying to get healthy. I've liked Carlos Santana in previous years, but also I would have had hesitation with him just being like 39 at this point. You obviously aren't playing him in a corner outfield. Of the other alternatives, I mean, I don't think that at the time, I probably just would have been more aggressive on Teoscar. If I went hard after Jock, I would have had probably an even worse hitter in my lineup right now than Anthony Santander. And if I would have went really hard after Tyler O'Neill, I would just be calling somebody up from the minors because I'd have someone else on my IL.
Yeah, it'd be Alan Rodon or Joey Loperfido, who's been doing a little better at AAA, by the way. And Rodon doing great at AAA. I guess the reason I posed the question is
what about
because...
You? How about you answer the question?
For me, I'd be fine with it. I think that $68.6 million over 5 years, you're talking $14 million a year for a guy who's got 25 to 35 home run power. Like, he's not going to carry your offense. I think that that was never a realistic expectation. That should be Vlad Guerrero Jr., maybe Bo Bichette. Santander is supposed to be a helpful player, not someone who's the driving force. And I think he can still be that. So for me, the 68.6 over five is still very reasonable.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think also that price and the fact that the Blue Jays like got him on it kind of tells you something about what the market thought of Anthony Santander. Tells you something about what the Blue Jays thought of him, right? Like, they weren't giving him like Teoscar money, present day value. They certainly weren't giving him Pete Alonso money, present day value. I mean, did he even get like Jock Peterson and Tyler O'Neill money, present day value? I don't think so. So the sticker price of it really does mask the fact that, like, when you factor in present day value, it's not that big of a deal.
No.
So much of it is deferred.
Yeah. He gets the 5-year term, but on a per year basis, similar to O'Neill and less than Jock Peterson.
Right. You know, you're talking about like Michael Conforto money. It's just Conforto only got a year, right?
Right. So I think that's just worth remembering in this. I mean, people can have different opinions. I'm sure some people listening to this are like, yeah, give me the $68 million. We'll find something else to do with it. And look, after the way it's gone, I get that. But my personal view is I think there's more to be had here. But as long as we're looking at some of those deals, let's do a little check-in on some of the moves that the Blue Jays made. And understanding, not saying that this is like the definitive, hey, this is like the final word on whether these deals are good. But I think it's worth checking in on. And yeah, just taking a look. So let's move over to Jeff Hoffman. $33 million over 3 years. I'll throw that one to you. What do you think about that deal as we're looking at it, you know, almost 2 months into the season?
Zero issues with it. He's obviously had that little stretch where he wasn't commanding as well as he needs to. And I think that was mostly fatigue related. I have zero issues with that deal. I'd do it again 10 out of 10 times.
Same. I think that deal is like a... absolute home run deal at this point. He looks healthy. He looks dominant. I know that he had a couple rough outings, but this is a guy who can really help you in the regular season and, more to the point, in the playoffs should you get there. Jimmy Garcia, another reliever deal, $15 million, 2 years. What do you got on that deal?
What do I even have to say? You do it 100 out of 100 times.
Yep. Agree with you there. That is looking like a good one. All right, Max Scherzer, we all love the Max Scherzer experience here, and I think we all agree that there have been benefits to having Max Scherzer around this team. $15.5 million over 1 year. He has pitched three innings to this point. I mean, what can we say about this one?
It's just as obvious as the Jimmy Garcia one, just in the opposite direction. You're paying $5 million per inning to this point. You hope Max Scherzer is going to get back healthy and effective, but obviously to this point, that's one you would undo.
All right. That is one that you would hit Command Z on. Miles Straw and international cap space for a player to be named later. That deal obviously was made with the hope of acquiring Roky Sasaki, but how are you looking at that one now?
Well, you know, if the player to be aimed later ends up being like Trey Savage, I won't love it. But if it's just an org guy who nobody's ever heard of before, yeah, of course. It's a great deal. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, and I think the main reason, obviously, was so that you could get that international cap space. But Miles Straw, I've come around to him as being a useful major league player. And I see him as someone who can help a good major league team in kind of a bench role. You don't want him playing every day, but he can certainly help you defensively. He can certainly help you on the bases. Plus, there's not zero value to increasing your international bonus space, potentially bringing in some young players there. I'm fine with that one at this moment in time. And obviously understanding the bigger picture pursuit of Roky Sasaki, I get that deal as well. There's another trade with the Cleveland Guardians that also deserves some attention here. So Andrés Giménez, someone who is on a $106.5 million contract, came over to the Blue Jays with Nick Sandlin for Spencer Horwitz and Nick Mitchell, a minor leaguer. Luis L. Ortiz went from Pittsburgh to Cleveland in a separate but very much related deal because technically it was Horwitz for Andrés Giménez. What do you make of that whole kind of three-team maneuvering at this point in time?
I still don't have a problem with it for the Blue Jays. So much of it will depend on just what Andrés Giménez becomes over the rest of this year and the next couple. Obviously, the offensive results to this point have been underwhelming, but we're only talking about, less than 150 plate appearances before he got injured. So it's just like too early to say the die is cast on who he's going to be as an offensive player this point or going forward, acknowledging that the results are underwhelming. To this point, the defense obviously is as advertised, the base running is as advertised. It's going to depend on whether or not the Blue Jays can get more out of his bat. Nick Sandlin, very useful reliever, very good for the Blue Jays until he got hurt. I think he's going to be an important part of the bullpen when he does come back and over the rest of the season. So I think you're happy to have him. And giving up Spencer Horwitz, I mean, that's a guy who's played like two games so far this year because he
just
got
back.
Right. He was because he had a wrist issue. And I think that the Blue Jays are operating from a position with like so much backfill of Spencer's Horwitz. When you think about like an Alan Roden or a Will Wagner, like some of the Davis Schneider, like some of the players that could like fit that mold for the Blue Jays, Addison Barger, even you could mention. I think they have so much backfill for what he was providing that it's hard to look at that deal right now and say you would undo it. I think that there's still some questions as to what Giménez will be offensively going forward, but I'm still making that deal.
Here's the one that I would throw at you here. So I agree and always agreed that it was the right time to sell high on Spencer Horwitz, given what you just outlined and just where you were at organizationally, what kind of defensive value he had or didn't have. It made sense to sell high on him. Now, was the right exchange to get Andrés Giménez and take on a significant contract in doing so? Or, I mean, this is where I would say the early read is maybe it's better to have $100 million to spend and Luis L. Ortiz. And, you know, if the Pirates were willing to give up Luis L. Ortiz to get Spencer Horwitz, maybe the 2020 vision is you take the pitcher who's, you know, he's got a 4.6 ERA, striking out 10.4 per nine. He's been in the Pirates rotation. Obviously hasn't been amazing, but this is someone with a somewhat of a major league track record, at least as a viable major league arm. And then maybe you take the 20 mil per season and do something else with that. Now, I'm not saying that the die has totally been cast. I'm not saying that, you know, that deal is written in stone one way or the other. But as long as we're doing an early assessment, I think that the early assessment is you'd probably rather have the pitcher in 20 mil.
I think if the Blue Jays could have taken that 20 mil and signed a second baseman who's a good defender, good base runner, and just league average hitter, I suppose, then yeah. Because I think they did need like an everyday solution at second base. Because like if you just look at what they had gotten from that position offensively and defensively since Marcus Semien left, leaves a lot to be desired. And I don't think that internally they had the answer. Internally, they could have gone with like Will Wagner there, or I don't know. I don't even know who else it would have been to start the season. Maybe Davis Schneider
and Ernie. Like,
yeah, and then but Ernie was playing
Barger third. At third, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe it forces Barger onto the roster. And
Stefanik.
Right. Yeah. Stefanik, you know. So, yeah, I think that they wanted more stability there and they wanted somebody who had more of a proven big league track record. So, yeah, I'm trying to think of like who the second baseman Glaber. Would have been. Yeah.
Glaber would have been the move. They had interest in him early in the offseason. I'm not under the impression there was ever a huge amount of traction there, but that's kind of the price point and the. Hey, this is a second baseman. He's probably available for around that same range as far as AAV that Jimenez is costing. Obviously a different profile because Jimenez is just an amazing, amazing defender and a good base runner. With Glaber, it's much more you're taking a shot on pop and taking a shot that he can post a 115 WRC plus for you.
Yeah, so if that was what I was doing and I was just like taking a shot on offense, I would have gotten Jorge Polanco.
Sure.
I don't only say that because he's like gotten off to a really hot start and had a great season, but I say that because I was advocating for the Blue Jays to like trade for him, like trade to the Twins for him a couple years ago. Like he was just a player who I liked a lot and who I thought was a really good fit for the Blue Jays. So I probably would have gone that direction. Actually, I might have gone the galaxy brain thing and gone Ha-Seong Kim direction. And had this guy sitting on my L for the first 2 months of the year, but then been banking on something coming up, you know, getting some payoff for that down the road. So those are probably the two avenues I might have taken otherwise if I hadn't made the Jimenez deal.
Yeah, and look, I mean this in the tone of like brainstorming and discussing and for the sake of discussion.
Yeah, we're just having fun.
Yeah, we're just having fun with it. And I think it's worth checking in because look, you look at the moves that have happened and that have worked out the best. The bullpen, right? Hoffman, Jimmy Garcia, the bullpen is the area that has meaningfully improved the most. And so you can see already, this is why we spend so much time in the offseason talking about this. And this is why we spend so much time at the trade deadline talking about this. When you have these chances to make moves, it actually has a pretty swift and significant impact on the team on the field because they went from a horrible bullpen to actually a pretty good bullpen in a quick period of time because of those moves. The offense, well, they wanted to improve the offense. They acquire Jimenez. They acquire Santander. Guess what? The offense hasn't been that great. And it's connected to the fact that the players they added haven't been that great. So there are long sort of runways ahead here for this thing to go better or worse or in between. But at least I find it interesting to do these check-ins. Of course, there's more time to go and we'll see where it all leads.
Yeah, I think you more so are like ruining the missed opportunities of like a Soto, a Burns, a Sasaki, Pete Alonso. Like you're more so ruining the players that you didn't close the deal on rather than the ones that you did. Because I think that in a lot of instances, the Blue Jays closed the deal on the ones that they did because of those circumstances or because Jeff Hoffman's deals fell through with other teams, not because these are the players who like on day one of free agency, they were aggressively pursuing.
Yeah, no, I think that's very fair. Yeah, I was talking to some people about this over the weekend. I think it takes like a good 4 years to assess a trade. Free agency obviously depends on the term of the contract before you can sit back and really say, was this a success or not? So, you know, these midway check-ins can only take you so far. But I'll tell you this, Arden, I did go down a huge rabbit hole this weekend looking at trades from like 4 or 5 years ago, because I think that at that point you can really fairly assess them. So hopefully there'll be an article or two on sportsnet.ca at some point. But I was down a huge rabbit hole. So that's where some of my mind was this weekend.
Can I go down a small rabbit hole before we depart here?
Let's do it.
Because I want to talk about Dalton Varsho, the good and the bad. The good, obviously, like offensively, he has been spectacular since coming back from the injured list. And we'll see just how sticky and sustainable some of the adjustments he's made are. But like, he's done a lot of work to improve his barrel accuracy, and it's showing up in a very real way with him taking over the team lead in home runs in like the span of 14 games. And also going opposite field more often, particularly for power. Like, the Blue Jays can unlock more fields for his power to play in. It's going to, I think, really raise his ceiling as a hitter. And so I think you could start to see some of the things that the Blue Jays thought they were going to see when they acquired Dalton Varsho from the Diamondbacks, coming off of like a 27 home run season in a ballpark where it's not easy to hit home runs as a 25-year-old. They thought, oh, this guy's going to just keep getting better, and we're going to get him into friendlier offensive environments, and the sky's the limit. Obviously, didn't quite go that way for the first 2 years with Toronto, but if some of these adjustments he's made with just the accuracy of his barrel can keep going, could be something interesting there. The bad, and it's like so weird to point out a flaw in Dalton Varsho's defense,
so
but
weird.
The guy's throwing arm is not there. Yeah. It is not back. He is clearly not comfortable throwing as hard with as much intensity as he was prior to surgery. You still want Dalton Varsho in center field because he's still going to track everything down. He's going to make those like 5, 10, 15% catch probability plays look like 99% catch probability plays. Like, you know, balls other guys don't even get to.
He's going to climb walls and jump and almost rob home runs that he has no business robbing.
He's going to fall down and just throw his glove out behind his back and catch a ball, right? Like, he's going to scale 12-foot walls. Like, he's just going to make plays other guys don't. You want him in center field.
Seems to normally have. Here's a drive to deep center. Varsho back. And did he catch that ball?
We knew Durant, but we're already seeing other teams start to recognize what we're recognizing, that his throwing arm isn't there. And we saw Colt Keith during the Tigers series tag up at second and go to third on a fly ball to left center to Dalton Varsho that was well in front of the warning track. And he couldn't get it to third base on a line. It bounced on its way in. We're seeing Bo Bichette and Ernie Clement and whoever else could be a cutoff man ranging way out into the outfield to give Dalton Varsho a shorter throw. We're seeing in the measurables, in the empirical data, that the hardest throw Dalton Varsho has had since he returned is 74.3 miles per hour. The second hardest is 67.4. So he has had one throw over 67.4. Everything else has been in the mid to low 60s, high 50s. And this is a guy who's never had a particularly strong arm, but who has averaged 82, 83, 84 in prior seasons. His max has been in the low 90s, and we haven't seen above
difference.
74. It's massive. It's clear that either the Blue Jays have instructed him not to throw like as hard as he can, or that he just can't. Like, one or
probably
the other
both
is true here.
I mean, clearly he can't. I think that's obvious. If he could, he would. He can't.
And so this is going to start showing up in big spots, Ben, as well.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm glad that you brought this up before we step away. But, you know, if a pitcher, and obviously an outfielder's arm is less important than a pitcher's arm, but if a pitcher had their average velo drop by 15 miles per hour, like, he would not be pitching, right?
We'd talk about it.
Yeah, if Chris Bassitt was showing up throwing 77 instead of 92... It's a big drop-off. Now, he can still play the position, as you said, but it's amazing how good teams are at pushing each other and exploiting each other. We're going to see it with the Rays against Dalton Varsho. I can guarantee you that. We'll probably see it with the Padres as well, but this weekend against the Rays, it is going to happen because they're so aggressive on that. And teams are ruthless. They are so aggressive. So they will see this little weakness, and they will push it and push it and try to exploit it. So something to watch. Again, great player, great outfielder, but something to watch.
Yeah, the upside of having him running down balls like outweighs the downside of the throwing arm not being there right now. Like, you'll take him in the outfield. It is what it is. But it's the sort of thing where, like, if it was the postseason, this could be a fatal flaw. It likely would be a fatal flaw. And it's the sort of thing where if it's the bottom of the ninth on the road in a tie game and there's less than two outs and a runner on third and there's like a fly ball to center and the runner's tagging up, you almost need a corner outfielder to sprint over and cut in front of him because he just has not demonstrated that he can make that throw home, you know, to try to stop the winning run from scoring at this time.
Yeah, put it this way. If it's in right center field and you got Addison Barger coming over, I'm pretty sure I want Addison Barger throwing from his strong side as opposed to Varsho trying to catch it and pivot his body and then throw. Clearly, that has to be Addison Barger. Not that he's playing a ton of outfield. But yeah, it's, you know, Springer, you want his arm. Lucas, he's been throwing well. So you've got to do that.
There isn't an outfielder on the club that you wouldn't want throwing in a big situation right now more than like Dalton Varsho. Like there is just, you would take it class A. You would if Alan Roden was up, you'd rather have him throwing. Like that's just, it's just where his arm's at right now. And I like, does it come back between now and the end of the season? Maybe, perhaps, we'll see. Is it ever going to be the same again? We don't know, right? But even like you just watch the throwing arm, like the throwing motion subjectively, and it doesn't look right. Like it doesn't look comfortable. No. It doesn't look like he's there. So he's clearly still going through a process here to get his arm back. I'm going to be interested to see how it evolves. But I'm pretty much certain that at some point there's going to be a big spot where this gets revealed in a big way. It's kind of been like a beneath the surface thing where if you were looking for it, you've seen it. And obviously 29 other teams have seen it and we've seen it. But there is going to be, I think, a sort of a magnifying glass moment at some point where this rears its ugly head, unfortunately, for just because of how good he is out there otherwise.
The Rays. Watch for it with the Rays this weekend. We'll see. But yeah, I mean, to Varsho's credit, he's clearly not 100%. He's still taking the field. So he's trying his best, giving the team what he can at this point.
And could you imagine this offense without him in it right now? I mean, he's contributing so much at the plate. He leads the team in home runs after 2 weeks.
So he's got a lot to offer. But that is all we have to offer today on At the Letters. Thank you so much for listening. Arden, thank you for your contributions. Christian Ryan, thank you for editing and putting this all together. And we will talk to you very soon on At the Letters.